here we are, episode 189. It's not like we just recorded 190. welcome, listeners. This is a bit of a pre-recording of Mars on Life. We're stepping a little bit away from the news and moving along with our regularly scheduled programming. So obviously we'll talk more about whatever else is going on in the world in the days and weeks ahead, but we felt a little bit remiss if we didn't mention this, especially due to the time of year and in part because we're almost done with the season, to have this discussion. Before I get into that discussion, introductions are in order. I am, of course, one of your co-hosts, Ryan Mancini. Who's with me today?
I'm Andrew Martinez, a longtime guest of the Mars on Life podcast.
You're a co-host.
titles are funny games. They're hilarious.
With this episode, we're finally doing something that Andrew and I have been talking about doing for, I don't know, probably since the start of the season. I forgot when you first brought it up, but as of when this episode premieres, it'll have been 1 year since the death of Mike Davis, who is certainly a name that's familiar with anybody that listens to this podcast. I know I introduced him to the show a couple of years ago, or his work, rather. This is kind of our opportunity to talk a little bit about him, talk about his work. I know I'm certainly going to not make this feel like a lopsided conversation because I think you've only read Ecology of Fear so far, whereas I've got surrounding me 10 of his books, including an 11th book where he wrote the introduction that I have read them all. But first things first, Ecology of Fear, it's a weird place to start, but I feel like that's kind of the best place we can start. What did you think of it?
Yeah, you know, this is my first introduction to Mike Davis, the, closest thing to what an LA historian that's, you know, pretty widely known. I mean, I've seen his books in Boston bookstores, so that's, you know, pretty good when you're looking for something to talk about where we're from, Los Angeles. And my first read was Ecology of Fear. Basically, you know, I guess to put it in modern terms, like really a look at climate change before climate change was really part of the modern conversation. This book, I believe, came out before Al Gore's movie, you know, before this was really kind of a bigger discussion. So a really nice read for the time, I think. It's a look at Los Angeles specific, not even California at large, but Los Angeles, and really just telling readers that Los Angeles is a really unique place. And I haven't read any of their Mike Davis books, but I'm sure he's described how it's been really corrupted by capitalism. But it's a melting pot of not only cultures, which I'm sure he describes in some of the other books, but also just of climate, earth, animals, fauna, flora, everything. And a book like Ecology of Fear really just, he does a great way to show out us what we're missing out on, what we're racing. So it's a good read. I think his writing style, you know, that's something I do want to get into because I read more of his books, but I kind of really enjoy his tone, his voice. He is, you can tell which way he leans, maybe not so much in Ecology of Fear, but you figure he's not a conservative, but he's kind of snarky. I think like you see it in like, I remember seeing some of the first photo captions in the book and it's just like, the captions are just like super snarky. And I'm just like, okay, this guy's serious. This isn't just some milquetoast like, oh, like, you know, there used to be lions here. Like, no, he really gets into it. And I think another thing that's really interesting was, well, of course, it's a well-researched book, but, you know, I think he, in the intro of the book, he kind of talks about how, you know, this is the updated version with, you know, you haters looked at my footnotes and found the smallest discrepancies. Oh, page 46, not page 48. Like, and he goes back and he says, like, nah, I got you. So I think that he really backs up his stuff. You know, he doesn't really, it's well researched and you could feel like the passion behind it. So I think it's an enjoyable first read. We could dive into this, but you know, the sense I got is that Mike Davis is has a really strong voice, I think. He's not he won't put you to sleep on some of these topics that growing up you saw these books in the libraries and you're just like, oh boy, I'm not touching that.
Yeah, he one of the things that has definitely really, kind of made me feel more for the guy is, especially in his later years, I felt as though there was more of a candidness on his own history. And, he never, unlike a lot of people that I've read from, and it's testament in his last book, Set the Night on Fire, he's not autobiographical, and that's something that, for me, it's something I battle with, where it's like I do want to read more of who I'm reading from, especially if they have a personal story relevant to whatever their main point is. Like if it's, I mean, just looking on my bookshelf right now, like if it's something by Barbara Ehrenreich, I mean, she puts herself into the story. She makes herself part of the story. Hitchens would always have an argument to make. There was always some aspect of the personal. With Davis, if anything, I guess the personal is, and this is part of the critique that he gets, is that, oh, he's always looking for the worst in things. He's looking, he's, it's all confirmation bias. But I think, if anything, part of the reason why something like Ecology of Fear, which I do think now has more of a, for the lack of a better term, fan base than it did, I think, when it came out, and City of Quartz, is that LA has become a much bigger focal point when it comes to politics and what left-wing politics can be in America, in contrast to what it was in 1990 or in 98 when Ecology of Fear came out. And we were talking about it earlier, maybe David Lynch read City of Quartz. I know there's like this long-running bit that there was some New York magazine or newspaper that got a picture of Bruce Willis and photographed him with a copy of City of Quartz that he was looking at, that he was reading, presumably. So it's definitely got a wide berth. But that's in stark contrast to, like, for example, Buddha's Wagon, which, A Brief History of the Car Bomb, like, that's probably a little less digestible. But again, the autobiographical nature, and I actually just pulled it up on my phone just a second ago, this article from The Nation magazine that came out before his death by Micah Utrecht, where he talks about Davis's background and some of the stuff that he's done throughout his life, and some of the weird little stories about him that you don't really get to read about elsewhere, except probably in Old Gods, New Enigmas, where it does start off a little bit autobiographical with his days as a truck driver and, as a butcher, and, meeting more working class people that ultimately led him into, a lot of those movements in the 60s and civil rights movement, which that was almost done more through family, because he did have, by marriage, he had black relatives. No relation to Angela Davis, as far as I know. But just reading a little bit here from Micah Utrecht. In Davis's introduction to The Bending Cross, the 2007 re-release of Ray Ginger's biography of Eugene Debs, he mentions that he first read the book in these years. Thanks to the powdered blue 55 Chevy that I plowed into a wall while street racing with drunken teenage friends, he was stuck in the hospital when his father gave him a copy of it. And there's other, there's other little anecdotes about how, he was in Watts during the 1965 uprising and narrowly avoided a fascist attack by right-wing Cubans on a movement center that involved the Gusanos tying up young leftists and spraying oven cleaner in their faces. I'm just kind of scrolling through a little bit further. I know there was some incident where he let loose a bunch of salamanders on somebody's office. And there's also this one great anecdote where he said, Micah says, working out of the New Left Review's London offices, Davis began editing for the journal. It was there that he also developed a reputation as a bit of a loose cannon. As Adam Schatz chronicled in his 1997 profile for Lingua Franca, the most complete biographical sketch available, After Davis received a letter from the historian Eugene Genovese complaining about the journal's treatment of his work, he responded with his own letter. Dear Professor Genovese, fuck you. In another moment of editorial anger, Davis spilled his atrarium filled with a garter snake and, I always can never pronounce this, axolotl. It's like those little white salamander things with the frill, and they always, like, they're smiling.
I have no idea.
And a carnivorous African toad onto the office's lush carpet. He would work out of the journal's London offices for 6 years before turning his energy toward writing. If anything, you read things like that, and, okay, this isn't John Meacham writing about the leadership qualities of Thomas Jefferson, or, you know, David McCullough writing about they built a bridge. Like, it's none of that kind of stuff. And obviously it is very ideological, but in that case, so what? You know, it's, if anything, it's giving an alternative voice in a time of, dare I say, consensus, not to sound repetitive to other things that I've said for the Falling Middle cast, but I don't really know how else we go from there. I mean, I know at one point you once said to me that you were, I don't know, it was almost like you had something critical you were gonna say, and I was like very fascinated.
Oh yeah, well, I mean, it's maybe specific to Ecology of Fear, and like, I don't mean to like jump this far ahead right now, but you know, one thing I thought about reading this book, I did not feel like it was too long. I think, you know, sometimes when you see stories like nonfiction books like this, or like a historical account, sometimes you're like, wow, it's too long or something like that. I think really digestible. But I think at least in Ecology of Fear, I feel like the book kind of lost some steam in the last chapter when he talked about the series of disasters. I don't want to say it felt like he just got tired or was just like, let me just finish this, but it's almost like he didn't know how to wrap up the last chapter. One of the last chapters of Ecology of Fear talks about, it's titled The Literary Destruction of Los Angeles. Talks about a series of every piece of media, whether it be movies, books, that talk about the destruction of Los Angeles by numerous means. And to me, that's kind of where the book started to fall off. It obviously is not something that makes me think he's a bad writer whatsoever. But I think I'm curious if this is something you've noticed in other books where, like, maybe he struggles to, I don't know if it's something where it's just like he didn't know how to like wrap it up, or if like he just has trouble writing about other media depictions of the stuff he's talking about. So I'm not saying it's like a weakness or strength. I've only read one book, but I think that my initial impression was that in the Ecology of Fear, I got the sense that maybe he didn't give as much of a shit, or like his editor might have told him, like, you got to list them all, because in every other chapter, it feels natural when he lists, for instance, all the instances of tornadoes in Los Angeles he never heard, or the sporting clubs that hunted down animals in Los Angeles he didn't know really existed like that, or at least in those numbers. So it feels natural in the other chapters, but when it comes to talking about other media, I thought it was really interesting that that's where it seemed to fall apart. So I'm curious if you've noticed that maybe some of the books don't finish as strong, or if you notice that maybe he's not as strong when he's talking about other media that discusses what he talks about.
It's a good point. I mean, I think that a lot of his work, having, you know, again, like this is all of his work that I have read at this point. You know, there's a couple other books here and there. Actually, there was one I remember giving you, I think it was Planet of Slums. Mm-hmm. And that, I know that's a book that it comes in high praise. I personally run into issues with it, and it's nothing to do with the content. It's just that I think, if anything, it is kind of a style issue. And, like, you know, I never want to say he's repetitive in his work, because he's not. I mean, I genuinely think each of these are very independent of each other. I mean, obviously, with Ecology of Fear, you know, for the most part, it was intended to be the sequel to City of Quartz. Initially, it was supposed to be a book about the LA riots, but he didn't want to write about that, as far as I know. So he was like, no, actually, I got this other thing about LA that I think is pretty important that I want to write about. And again, at the time, people were like, eh. But in hindsight, it has become, I think, more important, especially with California ecology being more and more of an issue in the face of climate change, wildfires, the bloody hurricane that it just had, that is staggering to even think that was ever a thing, and especially it's a thing that we've had a chance to see from afar. But to go back to your question, I mean, yeah, I think too, it just depends on the subject matter, because like even Buddha's Wagon, in some ways it's a history on terrorism in the 20th century, but it's obviously isolated to the whole concept of a car bomb and its usage in various struggles, various revolutions, various uprisings around the world. And even the back of the book says, in this provocative history, Mike Davis traces the car bomb's worldwide use and development in the process of exposing the role of state intelligence agencies, particularly those of the United States, Israel, India, and Pakistan, in globalizing urban terrorist techniques. And, you know, even when I read it, I mean, it's absolutely worth reading and worth owning. But like even this, you do get to kind of a point where it's like, you know, it all starts to kind of get muddled towards the end, and you're kind of like, okay, where is this all leading? Is there a point? Is he gonna have like a final argument? Admittedly, it's been a while since I've read Buddha's Wagon, but it is a little bit dated in the sense that it does wrap up around the early 2000s. I mean, I think the last chapter is called Planet Jihad, so or no, The King of Iraq. That's the I think that's the final chapter. No, The Gates of Hell. But there's a few books here and there, and you know, with Planet of Slums, it is kind of textbooky as well. And yeah, there is the dated feeling where it's like, oh, by 2020 this will happen. By 2030, like sometimes those kinds of books put me to sleep. But the rest of these, I mean, even Ecology of Fear does that too, sometimes, but it's the rest of the picture that he paints where I'm thinking, okay, is this where the book stands the test of time? Like City of Quartz, like Ecology of Fear. And then the rest of these, you know, one, you know, this was a book that he reissued, for obvious reasons. The Monster Enters. It was previously called, I think it was previously called The Monster at Our Door. And it was just strictly about avian flu. And then COVID hit, and he wrote, he reissued this, but he also wrote this like 45-ish page introduction talking about COVID, talking about how everyone wants to point the finger at Trump not being prepared, but Obama wouldn't have been prepared for this, George Bush wouldn't have been prepared for this, Bill Clinton wouldn't have been prepared for COVID-19, like talking about that kind of stuff. And then detailing how, for the most part, you know, with SARS, AIDS, avian flu, we've been completely open. We've opened up Monster Enters, Monster at Our Door. We've opened the door for a pandemic to happen. And like that in of itself is enough to make me think, yeah, that's where he does have a good point that is worth holding on to, especially if you know, talk with people about health, preparation for pandemics or the lack thereof in the case of our government. I think for the most part, he sticks the landing. Because even City of Quartz, like, you do kind of wonder where, how does this end? Where is it going to end? You know? And you realize, like, it's the journey that makes it that timeless read that I would argue has helped me understand a lot of cities, including the one I currently live in, frankly.
I think one question I have for you is really just when it comes to, I suppose, if contemporary historian is the correct description of him or something, because yes, he does have, I hate to say it this way, I suppose, but an attitude. Like, there might be some really traditional conservative voices that are just like, ah, garbage or something like that, you know, or like he has his haters for sure. But I'm wondering if you think, you know, this is like, I hate to say like the blueprint. He didn't invent contemporary historical writing, but if you think this tough style of writing is, what is it, apt for today's times? Do you think it's maybe too fiery? It sounds weird to say that. Do you think maybe he should maybe loosen it up to sway those detractors? I mean, do you think he's too off-putting for some people? I mean, obviously we are from the same, you know, we think the same, but at the same time, like, I'm curious if, like, you know, for instance, like, Set the Night on Fire seems like a nightmare for Fox News hosts to even consider picking up. But at the same time, I'm wondering if, like, maybe if this guy was more the textbook scholarly type. I can't think of another seemingly in-depth account of LA in the 60s like that. If, you might persuade some more people.
He definitely had his sort of return to academia later in his life. He already had kind of the bona fides of being, I feel safe in knowing the fact that like he did refer to himself at times as a communist. Like he, that in of itself was enough for people to feel a little, for lack of a better term, icky towards him. But I also think that it was, it's the prophetic nature of his work that I think is what ultimately draws people to him. Myself included, a lot of people, when they look towards Los Angeles and they want to understand it, or they're wondering what's the best book about Los Angeles before that came out. And even, Set the Night on Fire, it's a great history, but it's, and it came out at the weirdest time because it, like, I remember reading that. I think right around the time George Floyd was killed. Like it was, and that's close to when it came out. Like that's how bizarre it was that the fact that his work stands the test of time. It's always relevant. And City of Quartz, 30 years after it came out, it's still the kind of book that a lot of people turn to as the best book about Los Angeles. Not because it's, it's giving you the straight-laced, well, somebody put a stone down and said, "I declare this Los Angeles." Like it's not that kind of history. If anything, it's more like an updated follow-up to, if anything, I know for a fact it's meant to be an updated follow-up to, oh goodness. I think it was Cary McWilliams of The Nation. He had written a book called like Southern California, an island in the desert, or something to that effect. I might have to look it up. But he had written that book up to a certain point, and Mike Davis was kind of like, "Well, I'm gonna continue from there. I'm still gonna talk a little bit about the older history of LA, but I want to carry on from there, but also give it my understanding of the facts and what I see being the problems that this city has, and with itself." I think there's that accessibility, but I think what you were alluding to is there's kind of a doomer quality with his work. On one hand, it's not, and I think I've said this before with Sebastian, like it's not black-pilled, thankfully. It's not completely hopeless. And even before he died last year, like he said a bunch of amazing things just before he had passed, where he was talking about still having hope, still thinking there's a lot to gain from the future before us. And I've written about all this apocalyptic stuff throughout my career, but that doesn't mean there won't be a better tomorrow. To, again, not to be cliche or repeat myself from last week's show. So it's, if anything, it's giving a primer for others to have an idea on how you can responsibly call out bullshit, call out, travesties of the world, and be as analytical, be as scientific, be as polemical, be as political as you want to be, and still get that point across. And even if, it winds up being a bunch of damn activist Zoomers in LA, hey, you know what? They're the future. So, even if they're going to listen to a crotchety old communist who's, in his late 70s, big deal. Like, if they get it, if they know, if the kids are all right, then giddy up, And even his own kids were, they've been involved in activism from what he said.
I mean, one thing I always thought about this, like, I feel like I, how do you class, like, what do you classify in the Barbara Ehrenreich, like, Mike Davis, like, type genre? Like, is one author a gateway to another? Is it fair to put him in the same category? Like, for the young, for the young liberal, like, seriously, like, where does somebody begin, though? Like, I feel like, to be honest, like, Ecology of Fear, like, for me, my first intro is also like a pretty heavy intro to Mike Davis. I think, the monster I mean, that's a nice light book. Planet of Slums is nice and light. Like, I don't think anybody's going to start with Set the Night on Fire, but I'm curious because Barbara seems like so accessible. I mean, Nickel and Dime, her biggest book, I believe. It's like, what, 200-ish pages?
It's a
Like,
short read, yeah.
yeah, five chapters. And it's like, so to me, it's
And
like,
it's almost like a narrative. It doesn't read, it's not like I almost said the name of the podcast miniseries. It's not like Fear of Falling, which is like a layered history book that is almost on the level of a Perlstein book,
yeah, so I suppose like, if that's like your intro course, like is Mike Davis like, I don't know if it the main course necessarily, like, because I find it hard to categorize him, 'cause like, I remember when you moved out here, we had the discussion, I forgot if it was on a pod or not, like, what's the Boston version of Mike Davis? Like, what do you call Mike Davis? And I just keep saying contemporary historian, but that somehow also feels like selling him short a little bit. I don't know if you what you would classify him as.
Well, the other amazing thing about his work that I never had a grasp of it from anyone else that I've read, especially anybody. I mean, it goes without saying, Mike Davis, Barbara Ehrenreich, you want to run the gamut of other favorites, Albert Camus, Edward Galeano, Hitchens. Like, for the most part, these were all people of the left. They all talked about a lot of the same topics, a lot of the same issues, until they didn't. In Davis's case, though, and this is something that he brings up in City of Quartz, and ultimately it was City of Quartz that put me on this path of really observing this and taking stock in it and trying my best, even though, living in New England, I'm a sucker for the architecture. I will admit, like, there's times where it's like, oh, it's old Americana, it's really old Americana. And then, like, I go to Springfield, and at one point, I think it was like, I don't know if it was the Dr. Seuss home or what, but it's like they dropped his home from, I don't know, Southern California and just plopped it in Springfield. And you're like, wait, that's a Spanish style building. What the hell am I looking at? The point I'm getting at is architecture. That's something that I know. Oh God, I'm blanking on the guy's name. But there's a certain author, and I think he was an architect too, that Davis refers to a lot in City of Quartz. Goodness gracious, what is the guy's name? It's like Raynham something. Oh, here we go. Rainer Banham, who, I know has his own history on the architecture in Los Angeles. And ultimately, that was something that Davis followed up upon in City of Quartz, where he is talking about sort of the. My glasses go. He is talking about the kind of dystopian, the dystopian aspects of California and how, architecture can reflect what is going on with society, what is going on politically, how do local governments view people? I mean, a good example is, there's one edition of City of Quartz that features the LAPD building in downtown. And I don't know if you've seen it or you've been by it. I know I walked by it with friends in general, but also friends of the show, Pete and Kenny, where it legit looks like something out of Star Wars. Like, it looks like something that, it's a creepy, weird building that just doesn't fit in with the rest of the city. And he kind of uses that as a bit of a point to talk about, is this Blade Runner, or is this the, shiny city with the, Spanish style buildings and the Art Deco? Like, what are we? What is this? And all, and I'm not even doing it enough justice in describing it, but I will say that it was enough for me to really take that into consideration, especially seeing other cities across the country during my trip last year. And everywhere I go, I mean, hell, I go to Boston and I see City Hall, and you and I have poked fun at it, and I do think of what he would say, looking at it, probably thinking this is like a bureaucratic monstrosity frozen in carbonite, you know?
Yeah, talk about an example that's the nail on the head. And they even down the street from where we're talking right now, Worcester City Hall is classic. Well, I don't know if it's classic New England, but it's more what you'd expect. So, that totally makes sense. I still have yet to read City of Quartz. And one thing about City of Quartz that I thought was interesting, when was it published? Like 1990. It's the thing about some of these, like, I hate to use the word again, contemporary history books. The thing about like these type of books that I'm always curious is like, so Ecology of Fear, yes, written 1998, but relevant as ever, like when we have literal tornadoes, hurricanes, etc.
Oh,
Like,
yeah.
so relevant as ever. But like when you have something like City of Quartz, where I'm sure many of the ideas probably still hold true, but like when it
Oh, yeah.
comes to like,
I would say almost 100%. Like, and I know that sounds like a leap, but I mean, I'll be up front, everybody. I know you probably already can guess this. You listeners, everyone out there, City of Quartz is one of my favorite books ever by just how much it's kind of like Mulholland Drive, where the first time I didn't know what to make of it, and then subsequent readings, I was like, oh, I really get it now. And theories and ideas and things he talks about click into place when you look at the world around you. Anyway, sorry, I interrupted you.
Oh no, I was just gonna say, like, I would have to think about it for a minute, but like I know that there's been books that I've read in the past that are these type of contemporary histories where, yes, like you're supposed to go into these books with the knowledge of like this was published in 2016 or like 1992 or whatever, and it's like, yes, there is that caveat, there is that understanding when you go into this, but like I feel like, and I don't want to name names or can't name names just yet, but I feel like I've read some really bad examples of that where it's like no foresight, no like thinking ahead whatsoever, where like that seems to be one strength of Mike Davis, where he doesn't get too caught up in the moment, he's just like, let's see what happens in 1999, or like the Ecology of Fear doesn't have language of just like Y2K or just like like the big water act that's going to expire in 2005. Like I think like that's kind of something that like obviously much poorer writers kind of def like will suffer from, but like that's one nice thing about Mike Davis. I think last that how the lasting power of your book is obviously a good indicator of how good your book is, but I think when it comes to Mike Davis, he's the first contemporary historian that I've seen that like it actually does a really good job of like kind of having that evergreen kind of status when you read it. So I was kind of wary of that with City of Quartz because I mean wasn't there like a recession or something going on or like some weird business reckoning in downtown LA or something? I don't know.
Maybe. I think going in closer to the riots, I think there was. Because I think I remember I think we had it we talked might have talked about it during our LA riots anniversary episode. I think there was, yeah, because it was I feel like it was part of what led to George Bush's downfall going into 92, and the riots happened while he was still president, and that just further dumped on him, besides the fact that he had Ross Perot and Bill Clinton for some reason looked like a better alternative. It was also funny, not to go on a minor digression, but going through the index and I see Kim Stanley Robinson's name. Because believe me, there are like people, there's a little bit of the literary LA thing that you talk about with Ecology of Fear. There's a little bit of that in this. He does talk about Kim Stanley Robinson. He does bring up Bukowski, John Fante, who was, I think Bukowski described him as his god. He kind of set the groundwork for writing and how to craft a story within LA that Bukowski was like, oh, I could do that too. Yeah, there's a lot of things in here that, names like Tom Bradley and Daryl Gates, like there's a ton of names that are definitely dated, quote unquote, but at the same time, there's still this sense that like here's if you want an explanation for why all these things are the way they are in LA, this explains it. The actors may have changed, the movers and shakers may have aged out and been replaced, but what's new? Other than, if there was ever a good example of what is new, it's simply the fact that LA is on one hand, it's still very much the dystopia he describes it as being, I think. But also, there is a renewed, more, there's more of a left-wing push in the city than I think it's ever had in its history. And I'm sure he was at, he was, I mean, I know he was aware of it. I know he was admirable of it, but it, you know, it, and it gave him hope. But there was still that sense that, like, there needs to be more. More can be done. Because, you know, it goes without saying, and, you know, you had asked it earlier. He is definitely a contemporary of the likes of Barbara Ehrenreich, Christopher Hitchens. I mean, you know, he, for goodness sake, I think it was in, well, probably even mentioned that. You know, I mentioned to you a blurb on the back of Brightsided by Hitchens to Ehrenreich. On the back of Nickel and Dime, there's a blurb from Mike Davis saying, you know, this is why you got to read this book. Like all three of them have written about each other, and it's so weird and bizarre. And there's moments where you're like, is that a shot at why, you know? And it's funny now, you all these years later, having the initial, you know, and it might be a little difficult trying to find the actual article, but I don't know. Actually, before I even get into it, you know, noticing the time, is there anything else further with City of Quartz and Ecology of Fear you want to mention? I might kind of blast through the rest and.
Yeah, I mean, I think the thing with Ecology of Fear, I mean, you know, I'll put in my, you know, oh, required reading, but it really is because, like, I think it's funny how growing up in LA when there was weird weather, like, yeah, we were kids, we didn't know any better, but like, people still act like tornadoes are like crazy, and this book's just like, nah, they're normal, you know, or just like, oh no, P-22, RIP, and it's just like, well, there's like hundreds of mountain lions and things like that. So I think this book does a really good job of like, you know, California history is not going to teach you this stuff. It's not some sort of Howard Zinn, like, you know, here's the history they don't teach you type of deal. Like, I think it's just really kind of an example of like, you know, who is there to tell this story? And like, so, you know, right, I do love it. It does open the door for other things. I feel like City of Quartz is like got to be the next one, but like, or Set the Night on Fire. But I feel like it can't go wrong.
I know Sebastian and I did a whole episode talking about it, but the chapter, it's one of those things where when people talk about Mike Davis now, and even before he died, they talked about it. One of the most memorable things that he wrote that people were like, whoa, was the chapter, The Case for Letting Malibu Burn. And, you know, it's definitely something that you think about that chapter and how fires are, you know, responded to in California and where fires happen and how they're responded to by firefighters and various fire departments. And it just further contextualizes that it's less, you know, yeah, there is the climate change element. Yes, there's kind of the colonialist element of like, well, American Indians were burning things down, but you know, we're just gonna, you know, let downtown burn, but we have to go save the rich people because, you know, whoa, capital, whoa. But anyway, I mean, there's a essay, I think, later in Dead Cities, which this was the last book of his that I picked up before I moved. It's one of those books of his that is hard to get. I got lucky and found a relatively cheap, good condition copy that when I read it, I mean, you know, I think I said it to you earlier, before we started recording that this is where he finally wrote about the LA riots. And, you know, initially when I first heard about it, I thought, oh, he's just writing about very, it's City of Quartz 2.5, where he's writing about other cities, but it's so much more than that. And you're just, you know, it does blend a little bit of those two books, but it's still a little bit, stepped away from Los Angeles, except when he gets right into it. But at some point, there's an essay in here where he's talking about 9/11, and he says something to the effect of like, you know, oh, Christopher Hitchens, the master of irony, doesn't see the irony of the Twin Towers burning. And then in one of those Hitchens essay collections I've got, he's like, you know, oh, sorry, Comrade Davis, I fail to see what you're talking about. You know, like these folks, they knew each other, you know. And you know, I like that, but also it's fascinating when you see all their trajectories and how, if we want to talk about, and then I'll get back to their devotion to left-wing politics, Ehrenreich and Davis win, but Davis gets the first prize medal. Like he never swayed out of the lane. I know there was one thing he wrote just before he died that some people took some issue with, where he made it seem like as though we don't have enough voices now, enough contemporary left-wing voices to say the quiet part out loud about X, Y, and Z. And some people were like, whoa, hey, we got a lot of, you ever heard of Hassan Piker? Like things like that. And yeah, you have that, but at the same time, like I get where he's coming from in that, there is an aspect of like, is it all performative? Is it all just for clicks? Or, what action can you actually do besides being a streamer, which might sound too harsh.
No, I mean, he's in the era. I don't recall him ever being like, oh, like the Mike Davis Twitter account. He's got a real snarky one today. Like he was never that kind of guy who transitioned to that. I can't think of another. But yeah, like that's another point that's interesting. Like who is like the right-wing counterpart to Mike Davis that's respected even in right-wing circles? I mean, yes, they have their own problems and infighting, but I can't think of another strong example like this where it's just like, oh, well, at least we can say that so and so is the most respected conservative writer of our day. I mean, not even talking about the political drivel of like why America's lost its values, with some asshole with his arms crossed on the cover. Like, I think for me, like, and of course I haven't read some of the other histories like, Perlstein or anything like that, but I can't think of anybody else who compares today who's like the closest thing to like our most respected moderate contemporary historian or most respected right wing. Like when's the last time one of these books kind of like rocked the nation? I mean, you have books today like, I was I guess mistaken that Work Won't Love You Back came out. I could have sworn it came out like this year, but like, stuff like that, like a lot of the stuff is dealing it seems to a lot of the hot stuff today seems to deal with like cultural issues, but putting it in like a historical political context. I mean, I haven't read some of these books, but I'm wondering if like, what is the who's the next Mike Davis? Who's going to be the best example of that? Who's like the other contemporary historians that like are as quality as this?
It's sad. Right now, it's harder to say just because, he's more of a journalist and he is also Barbara Ehrenreich's son, but like one contemporary voice that does kind of fit that mold would be Ben Ehrenreich. His book Desert Notebooks, which Mike Davis also had a blurb for, does try and blend a lot of history, a lot of mythology, and in a lot of ways it is very much like what would Mike Davis write about now were he, in his 30s, 40s, or 50s, rather than, something that was written back in the 90s. So in fact, I'll take a look and see what his blurb was, because it might show a little bit more insight why he gave a damn. Let's see here.
And and as you looked that up, I was just thinking aloud, like I even purchased like for instance Malcolm Harris, Palo Alto, and
Oh
like his other book, The Kids Aren't All Right. I guess those are fair examples.
Sorry, I remember minor note. I remember when Malcolm Harris like tweeted out, "Hey, does anybody have Mike Davis's email?" Yeah. And people were like, "What?" And he was like, "Yeah, I found his old like I forgot what UC he was working at. I guess it was UCSD." And he was like, "Yeah, I'm trying to get him to like read my book and get a blurb and recommendations. So I'm just being nice. Like I'm not trying to be a schmuck."
I didn't realize that. Yeah, like for instance, like those are good examples, but like I don't think things like I haven't finished Palo Alto. I enjoy it, but like it doesn't carry the same weight as like a Mike Davis book, I don't think.
Oh
Like I
wow,
think
okay.
like no, it's like I haven't finished it, so like the verdict is still out, but even just like it just feels like, I love what you said, like saying the quiet part out loud. I feel like he kind of like for instance, I didn't realize this is a super tangent, like there's a series of suicides by high schoolers and young adults in Palo Alto on railroad tracks, and he's like, like let's examine the ghost of Palo Alto and see like how this all began or the historical context. But It doesn't just have this, it doesn't carry the same bite, you know? Like, I haven't read Malcolm Harris's other work, but like, in my own little bubble of reading, I guess, modern versions of this, it's just like, it's missing the attitude, the edge that Mike Davis had, even in my small sample size, and it's a little disappointing, you know? I'll see how the book finishes up, but like, I'm not gonna go to, what's the dude's name, the biographer of Jobs and Musk, and like,
Oh, Walter Isaacson.
yeah, like I haven't read Walter Isaacson, but even just from like, I don't want to call Malcolm Harris a lightweight by any means, but like I just feel like it's just missing the punch that like elevates other things. So that was a tangent, but the verdict's still out on that one.
So, I have removed more books from the shelf. But just to read here the blurb from Mike Davis, and it does, this book came out, I think, goodness, when was it? 2020. But this edition came out in 2021. So, of all the books that they ran through, it says Mike Davis, author of City of Quartz. So it speaks for itself. Ehrenreich's Mojave is both eternal and despoiled, a measuring rod for the apocalypse and proof that nature abides. This haunting meditation on terminal capitalism and its unthinkable future clearly establishes its author as one of our greatest essayists, wholly contemporary with these strange times. And, and then even just reading the next one from, and I might butcher the name, I apologize, Sesshu Foster. Climate change California is burning as Ehrenreich's meditations prismatically refract heat, smoke, and light. Personally, this is another favorite that it genuinely blew me away when I read it. I recommended one of his other books last week. He is a journalist by trade, much like his mom. He went to the Middle East, he went to the West Bank, to Palestine, and I mentioned his first nonfiction book last week. So he's a remarkable author, and I think I would say for the most part, even though he doesn't dedicate the whole book to where he's in or where he's at. Like, he definitely moves around and talks about LA and other places. He talks about Las Vegas, which Davis certainly has, and dead cities. But like he I would say right now he's the closest that's living. I mean, that's the trap I've fallen into with Davis's passing, is that for the most part, all my favorite writers, save for Ben Ehrenreich, are dead. But I guess if anything, it goes to the testament of your point, which is, who today carries their torch. And yeah, there's a lot of people that do, but I think also, it was hard back in the day for, Davis's work to really break through. And I haven't even gotten to Prisoners of the American Dream yet, but when you are fighting consensus, when you are fighting, dare I say it, establishment voices, and you've got a much more radical opinion to sell and share, you are going to come off sounding a little bit like a crank. And I know that was an issue people had with Davis. And actually, I did find the Hitchens part in here in Dead Cities, and Hitchens' response. Irony, of course, is now an illegal alien in the land of liberty. Even professional ironists like Christopher Hitchens police the sacred, quote, no irony zone that surrounds the ruins of the World Trade Center. Otherwise, it might be possible to draw various parallels between Jimmy Herf's nightmare in Manhattan Transfer of a skyscraper falling on him and the hatless bourgeoisie of the expressionist apocalypse. To which the Post, one of the New Left's outstanding members, Mike Davis, was shortly to write that it was ironic that I, the supposed master of irony, could see nothing ironic in the wreckage of the World Trade Center. Well, no, I couldn't, and I, well, no, I couldn't, and no, I still cannot, and I maintain that any irony involved is strictly at the expense of Comrade Davis. This is also after he wrote about doing his own little like drive on Route 66 to LA, and he does bring up City of Quartz, but even then he didn't get enough into it, and I was like, what's with you, my guy? We've talked about the LA books. Prisoners of the American Dream, if you want to talk about like a good, I guess, contemporary history, I mean, for one thing, it is In a lot of ways, I put it in a similar category as Fear of Falling. The diff, you know, with the fact that it also ends in the late 80s, and it is sort of a long history on, you know, middle class culture in America. Or rather, that one's about the middle class, this one's about the working class. But it's timeless to a point, if anything. Like, this book wraps up with the Reagan era and Jesse Jackson and the Rainbow Coalition. So in some ways it gives you a little bit of a hint at the future with Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders in a really warped way, even though it's arguably not synonymous enough. But it was certainly the book that put him on some radars, some map. And then he did City of Quartz, and
Yeah.
that exploded.
Yeah, this is first published 86. So, yeah, and just looking through the chapters, it looks like he's got his little Age of Reagan chapter, Age of Reagan section. It's just like be interesting to dive into. Yeah, I feel like, you know, I again, like I feel like I don't want to say labor is like an easier topic, maybe easier to grasp. I'll say that. I know there's a lot more work on that. But I guess if you had to say like a Davis strength outside of writing about Los Angeles, got to be labor. I mean, if that's like his next bet, like, you know, what he's good at, I suppose.
Well, this one, and it was the same trouble I had with City of Quartz initially. The language and the prose, for one thing, it is different between the two. Like, he does kind of skirt his style away from sounding like most, you know, left-wing authors and writers, where it is very analytical. It is very, like, there's a lot of buzzword usage that frankly can put me to sleep sometimes.
Yeah.
You know, if anything, with City of Quartz, it was just the fact that it was so layered. Now I can read it and just be like, oh, it's like a good cocktail. You know, and with Prisoners of the American Dream, it's not. It is very much the, you know, Debsian socialism and, you know, the proletariat this, and but it still conceptualizes working class thought and theory and ideas by you know, contextualizing it within America, you know, talking about like the election of Andrew Jackson and how that was like a good step, or rather it was a step for democracy for the middle class, for the working class. It's just that it also had a lot of bad consequences because, you know, Andrew Jackson,
The original swamp, or
well, just like more like the original Trump, like, you
yeah,
know,
like
like
building the swamp, or like putting. I mean, my elementary understanding of Jackson was that he just essentially hired all his buddies.
that too, but he also, like, I mean, he got things accomplished, but then he also did a lot of the typical horrible, I shouldn't even say typical, well, typical for a president of that
Yeah.
time, where it's like, okay, you know, Indian Removal Act, you know, everybody's an enemy. And there's the famous moment where Martin Van Buren like sees him and he's like putting his jacket on or something, and Jackson's like, you know, the bank, Mr. Van Buren, is trying to kill me, but I will kill it. And then he did, you know, like the first bank of the United States, it's not real. I think currently we technically have the second bank, you know.
Yeah.
So and in some ways it's diving into, and this is something he gets more into in another book of his that we haven't really mentioned too much yet, but it's a phenomenal essay collection, called In Praise of Barbarians: Essays Against Empire. And you know, this is where he talks a little bit more about like populism and, you know, the threat of, you know, the mob and consensus, and how like you can have an honorable movement, but then you can also have sort of the again the mob mentality that you can potentially get with democracy. You know, which I know has been talked about and read about elsewhere. You know, something that the Adamses were scared of, and cults of personality are dangerous, blah blah blah. So that's kind of where he hones it in, and then he continues on with like what happened with Eugene Debs later in the 19th century. I mean, there's the funny thing too is that having since learned more about Eugene Debs including the Ray Ginger biography, The Bending Cross. Like, it does really make me want to go back to Prisoners of the American Dream and comprehend that a little bit more, and I'll probably understand it better. But I will say, to kind of go back to your point about, what is something to dive into first? Old Gods, New Enigmas, I don't think I'd recommend first, because that literally is the most, cerebral, the most theoretical, and it transcends everything else he's written. It's kind of like, okay, throughout my work, you see this long lineup of ideas. Now I'm going to finally talk about those ideas in abstract, and then also hone in on, how can they be applied in the 21st century, and also how can they be applied in this in the age of climate change. And what does it mean if we, find ourselves on Mars? Like, is there going to be a working class on Mars or something? And listeners, or any Mike Davis fans out there, they're thinking, well, we're remiss to not talk about Planet of Slums or Magical Urbanism or No One Is Illegal. Admittedly, that's my own fault in just not having read them. And, if I'm being honest, it does get to that point where material crosses over a little bit. And I just, Planet of Slums, I did try and read. Again, that one is critically lauded for essentially saying that there's going to be this, like, proletariat third world, or basically suggesting that, the further that we put people in poverty, the better chance that there could be some kind of global revolution of sorts, which again is a great thing to talk about and read about. But I would say, and this is where it gets to one of his books we haven't mentioned yet, it almost serves as like the analytical epilogue to late Victorian Holocausts, which I know Matt Christman said this, he thinks this is his best book. This one kind of overlaps with Planet of Slums and Ecology of Fear, arguably. Probably more so with Planet of Slums, just because it is talking about how, the empires of Europe drove several parts of, India, Asia, and Africa into complete ecological disaster and resulting in the deaths of millions of people just simply for the fact of, like, okay, we're going to knock these people down in terms of, cutting off food supplies, cutting off water, cutting off this, that, or the other, and, basically settling on their land, but we're going to reap the benefits of it all. And, hey, we got more territory, yay us. But in our wake, we're going to leave thousands upon thousands and millions of people gone. And, again, late Victorian Holocausts. I mean, in a lot of ways, the title says it for itself. The subtitle, which you have a better
Yeah,
chance
El
of reading
Nino
it.
famines and the making of the third world, and pretty self-explanatory, I would say, but it's the kind of stuff that this is like, I feel like sometimes too, like at least myself when I was younger, I would dismiss this because like I would be like, well, of course, like everyone got fucked over, but like you kind of need to understand the history. So like, I think this is really important because I think a lot of people just conflate a lot of the disasters of the what is it, colonialism? Like with they just kind of just it's like one big melting pot, but it's more nuanced than that. You need to understand who the players are and so forth. So like that kind of stuff, like I think is really important to that actually sounds like a really good one to jump into next. I mean, because I figure you might just hate LA and that's totally fine. So like it doesn't mean you have to totally discount the guy. So he's shown like a pretty good range.
And to jump back to In Praise of Barbarians quickly, because I feel like for the listener out there that, to your point, like, they don't want to read about LA. They're from, I don't know,
Montana.
they're from Butte, Montana, where Barbara Ehrenreich was from, like, and they're like, I couldn't give a single shit about LA. So you've already cut out probably, well, they'd probably cut out this one too, technically, but In Praise of Barbarians. But if anything else, I mean, if you wanted like a good, I don't know. I mean, like especially if you wanted to say, like, okay, well, what's a good book to read of his that talks about politics, gets a little bit more into his general ideas without getting too in the weeds. I think it would be In Praise of Barbarians. Yeah, there is some of this that goes into the typical LA stuff. I know Heavy Metal Freeway, which I think at one point he tried making into a book. And then, like, I've seen book covers for it, but I've never seen it sold anywhere. I know he wrote something about the 2012 election called, I think it was called, like, the Last White. Make sure I'm saying that right. I'm not turning into Elmer Fudd there. The Last White Election. And, like, it's like it's available. There's some websites where you can find it, and then there's, like, other websites where you're like, does this even exist? Like, it's little things like that. But, you know, there's things in here like, you know, The Unease and Gall, which is part three, where he talks about Heavy Metal Freeway, Cry California, Think Big, Recall the System, hint, hint, recall, The Day of the Locust, Striking Southern California, Mel's Nazi Matinee, Inside the Sunshine Gulag, Vigilante Men, Arnie Reprogrammed. Like, it's. You know, you can't help it, and he does talk about California in this, but, you know, he's talking about the border with Mexico, he's talking about Katrina, he's talking about George Bush. I mean, that certainly the Bush stuff dates this particular book, but again, it goes straight to the point. And, you know, he's got other reflections on here, like he's got one essay about Malcolm X. You know, it's hard to say. I mean, it's hard to say, like, what's a good, easy start with Mike Davis, just because, like, for me, it was sort of like, okay, I finally get the point of City of Quartz. Then I got Set the Night on Fire, which, as daunting as it is, was pretty readable. And I'm trying to even think, like, after that, it might have been Ecology of Fear, then In Praise of Barbarians, then Prisoners of the American Dream, something like that. So, and it's, yeah, it's kind of hard. I'm actually having difficulty thinking of, like, what's a good start. I almost would say City of Quartz still would have to potentially be, but if you didn't want to read about Los Angeles, I mean, late Victorian Holocausts, it's heavy subject matter. Like, even I was kind of reaching a point where I was like, okay, let's. You know, I'm sitting here in misery. Let's keep going. But at the same time, there is the value of, like, well, this is the timeless element that explains a lot of things for why the world is the way it is, and explains why, you know, the outcome and the what's the word I'm looking for? The outcome of Planet of Slums. So.
Yeah, I think first of all, if you've made it this far, I think you're willing to dive into some heavy subject matter. I think there comes the standard here is to start somewhere heavy. Mike Davis, I think we could also agree, is really accessible. Like Ecology of Fear, I think was actually really easy to read. But I think, if you're getting into Mike Davis, you're ready to get into some heavy stuff. So to me, I think, Set the Night on Fire might be daunting because of length. I guess there's two ways to look at a book, the length is too long, especially for nonfiction, that might be a lot, or the subject matter is too heavy. But if you're interested in Mike Davis, I think it comes with the territory. So for me, that won't be a barrier for me to get into. The only one, as you said, Old Gods, New Enigmas, that's a little heavier when literally you open the book and it says read Marx exclamation point. And it's like, how many people can even name Marx's bibliography or his work? So I think that's one discussion. But I think when you talk about late Victorian Holocaust, I mean the title's already kind of intriguing enough, but if you want to know how the world works, I mean you gotta get deep. So that totally makes sense.
And, you know, it goes without saying too. I mean, Old Gods, New Enigmas is, you know, it's a relatively slim volume. You know, it's only including the preface, it's basically five chapters. and it's under 230 pages, but I mean, just going off the headlines, the titles, just added myself there. Preface, Marks at the Chicken Shack. Chapter 1, Old Gods, New Enigmas, Notes on Revolutionary Agency. Chapter 2, Marx's Lost Theory, The Politics of Nationalism in 1848.
Yup.
The Coming Desert, Kropotkin, Mars, and the Pulse of Asia. And then chapter 4, Who Will Build the Ark? So, like, and this goes into something that I had mentioned on the Falling Metal cast with Sebastian, how Ehrenreich, Hitchens, Barbara Ehrenreich, I should say, both of them were pretty good at either coining a phrase or turning a regular phrase into a pretty provocative book title. You know, The Worst Years of Our Lives, talking about the 80s. Prepared for the Worst, also talking about the 80s. The book about Mother Teresa, The Missionary Position. This land is their land, like with our scribbled out and their written over it. And with Davis, you know, because there is that apocalyptic side of him, that again, it has credence because we see the apocalypse. You know, we see, you know, there's the famous LA Times cartoon that I think came out. I forgot when it. I know I ended up keeping my copy of it. It's at my parents' house, but it was, I think, post-COVID. It was certainly post-COVID because the illustrations show, Trump and Fauci, but it talks about everything from, you know, climate apocalypse, wildfires, one and the same, the pandemic, which you get with The Monster Enters, and it's like there's so much of that, and then obviously the protests, which you get with Set the Night on Fire. And I think, you know, with Davis's work, there is that sense always of impending doom. And I think in the times that we do live in, it frankly doesn't hurt to have somebody that is that frank about the future. I mean, I know in my professional life and even, you know, off the clock, I've been probably sounding more doom and gloom about everything from, oh, West Nile virus in Massachusetts, or flesh-eating bacteria in some local pond, or oh, hey, we might have a nor'easter this weekend. Is that normal? You know, stuff like that. And I, on one hand, I feel more emboldened knowing that Davis had the facts behind him, but also, if you want somebody that's going to be level-headed in these times, even though he's not with us anymore. He's a good, it's the guy that leads Virgil through hell. Dante. Virgil is the guy who leads Dante through hell. Virgil, like, if you want a good Virgil in this time, and I'm pretty sure somebody else has already made this comparison, but if you want somebody to lead you through the layers of hell that we live through, then he's a perfect guide. So, and I say that with all respect to him. I mean, he, you know, was called out a lot for being, you know, the doomer, and you know, people accused him of hating Los Angeles, and he was like, "Are you kidding?" You
He
know,
lives in San Diego, so
I know, yeah.
the secret good alternative to Los Angeles. But yeah, like he wasn't far from the action. He wasn't writing this stuff from like the East Coast. Nobody will ever accuse him of being a coastal elite, no matter what coast, I figure. And yeah, I think he left a good legacy. If not, maybe a little under, not shoot, what's the word I'm looking for? Like unheralded or underheralded? Like
Yeah.
yeah, so because like I. You're the only person I've ever heard even like be aware of him. So like, you know, I've
Okay.
seen his books in bookstores, but like it's not mainstream, you know, the same way like nickel and dime is in every single bookstore in America is probably still. So
Yeah.
yeah, he is he's not a hidden gem, but like he definitely is a voice that is due to be heard more.
Yeah. And I will say as well that, you know, with the likes of Christopher Hitchens, Noam Chomsky, a lot of other various radical voices, like Davis, just on the onset, I mean, he always came across as a very just average Joe guy. Like, he'd go to interviews, at colleges wearing like a flannel shirt or a button-up t-shirt, button-up t-shirt, button-up like collared shirt with short sleeves. He never came across as, Mr. You typically never saw him in a cream-colored suit like Hitchens, with, all the buttons unbuttoned, like show off the pelt, as Hitchens would call it. He wasn't the kind of prophet that people go to with Chomsky. It was more he was it was different with him. And part of that's probably just due to exposure, due to his career and what he was publishing. Chomsky was already famous in the 60s. For the most part, Davis hit it big in 90. So, in 1990. I think we've probably gone long enough at this point. But and as vague as we probably sounded this whole time, even though I feel like we've gone through the whole cinematic universe here, I mean, I'm still trying to wrap my head around like what would be. I don't even know if, because the shortest book here I have is The Monster Enters, and even that, like, I don't know. I guess, I mean, I even told my mom, who it talks about all the kinds of stuff she is a professional in, and I've told her, like, I don't know. I think you'd appreciate it. You'd like it. She already knows who he is, given he was born not too far away from where she was in SoCal. He was born in Fontana. She was born in and around San Bernardino, so not that far away. But if I'm being correct, I should know my San Bernardino geography. Am I being accurate, Andrew?
I don't know. Pete's gonna yell at us. Yeah, I don't know San Bernardino either. He might get mad that I even said that. But yeah, no, I don't know the geography out there.
Let me just get this right. I'm close. I'm close. I'm close. I am close. 21 minutes away from each other on Google Maps. Okay,
Nice.
close enough. And Rialto's right in the middle. Oh boy. Anyway, again, I think City of Quartz is always going to be a good start, but if you want something a little bit smoother, a little less chunky, and especially if you don't care about California, which totally okay. I don't know. I feel like you might be good with something like The Monster Enters, or I don't know, maybe even Buddha's Wagon, if you're curious about, like, especially now with, what's going on. Well, by the time this episode airs, who knows what the world will be like, but with when it comes to discussions on terrorism and uses of weapons of mass destruction, that could be an interesting primer for you. But and who knows, maybe you try all of them and you realize he's just not for you. That's fine too. Honestly, I'll leave that to listeners, because I love that you asked that question, but it's hard for me to answer it. So honestly, I love it when you do that to me, Andrew.
No sweat. Yeah, I'm looking at a stack of Mike Davis books now, and I know I'll be getting into it. I've actually have Planet Slums at home, but City of Quartz is that, the classic LA story, and we are Angelenos, if you can't hear the bias by now. But I think it all comes highly recommended, and I think by the quality of the reviews and recommendations, I mean, Hitchens cared enough to give him the time of day to write about him in a book, not even just like a snide comment. Like, no, Hitchens published about this guy. Like, this guy's serious, so you should take him seriously too.
And as I said, he even published about him in a positive light. Even in the same, well, different essay collection, but around the same time that approaching 9/11. I mean, I don't know. Any final thoughts? Do you think I'm obsessed? Do you think I'm crazy?
No, I mean, it's funny looking at the bookshelf. I think, like wait till we get into Hitchens one day, like full bibliography. But I think Mike Davis is a really nice kind of wedding between Los Angeles centric and, issues you all can care about. So no, man, I think this is a if you want to know more about why the way things are today, it's a good start.
Oh, yeah. So, with that, listeners, yeah, that's been episode 189. I can't believe it. 190, even though it's already in the can, it's, yeah, we're that close to the season finale. This and episode 200. This is weird. This is wild. But anyway, listeners, that has been Mars on Life, and wait until next week because the LA train just keeps going. What the hell's a Wookiee?
Mars on Life is a podcast co-hosted by Sebastian Shug, Ryan Mancini, Andrew Martinez, and Matt Fernandez. If you like this episode, rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. Subscribe wherever you listen to your favorite shows, as Mars on Life is available on Anchor, Radio Public, iHeartRadio, Audible, Spotify, and Podchaser. Find us on Instagram at Mars on Life Show to keep up with the latest news, episodes, and gratuitous updates on the Red Planet. Have a question, comment, or request? Email us at marsonlife@gmail.com, and we'll promptly get back to you. This show's artwork, titled Happy Mars, was drawn by Zachary Erbrick. Our show's regular intro and outro music is Space Explorers by the one and only Kevin MacLeod. Thank you for listening, and always remember, if you keep going, you'll make it to Mars.